Blog Talk Radio.
Hi there. Welcome to Teach Me to Talk, the podcast. I'm Laura Mize, pediatric speech-language pathologist, and thank you so much for joining us today. And I hope we can really get this show going this time. We've had technical problems on both ends, on my end with some internet problems today, and then some problems hearing the call with our guest. So this is our second official try, but I feel like I'm on try four or five kind of to get the show going today. So I hope that it goes and that we can again, get it all to work to enjoy this great mom. Now, today's show is going to be a continuation from show number 262. So my advice would be, if you've not listened to that show, I think you should stop right now. However you access our show, whether it's through iTunes or at my website at teachmetotalk.com or however you get the show, stop and go back and listen to show 262 if you've not heard it. It's a fantastic mom. She's from Canada. And again, she has twin little girls who are, I believe, turning four, if my memory serves me correctly. And last time we talked a lot about mom's feelings as she was beginning to notice some differences in her girls. And then she had to take them to one specialist and then another specialist. And she walked us through that whole diagnostic process with thinking, oh, this might be their hearing, it might be their middle ear infections. And then someone mentioned autism to her, and she felt like lots of moms do, really, really defensive. And she said she felt like she was in denial for a long time and tried to think of every other possibility beyond autism as an explanation for why her girls weren't meeting their communicative milestones and some of the social kinds of things that she saw other 1 and 2-year-old little girls doing. So it was just a great show, and especially if you are a parent involved in that, those first weeks of getting a diagnosis, and it doesn't even have to be autism, because I think that the feelings that parents experience when you realize that something might be right with the child, it really doesn't matter what the diagnosis would be. It really is. So again, you can go back and listen to that show, and I know that you're going to find some commonalities there, even if autism isn't exactly what you're dealing with. Okay, Laura, you're on now.
Hi, can you hear me now?
I can hear you now. That's much better. You were cutting out before, and sometimes when we have a guest and I can't hear it, the quality's not so great, I go back and listen to the show, and it's perfectly fine, but I couldn't even really understand all that you were saying, and so that would make it really hard for me to respond.
No, that's fine. It could be a connection too, so.
Yeah, you sound great now, though. It sounds 100% better. Okay, so let's kind of say what we said before when we were on and trying to get this to work. Last time, we got to talk about one of your little girls, and then today we said, well, I said at the end of that show, I want to have you back on so we can talk about the other one of your girls. But I think you said, if I heard you correctly, you would give us kind of an update with what's been going on since then, and then we'll move on to your newer question.
Yeah, I think we left off at, we didn't talk about Twin B. So we, like I mentioned before in the last podcast, we've been working with a great OT who was able to diagnose some sensory issues. So both girls are sensory seekers. However, they're very different. Twin A would be an indirect sensory seeker, so she knows what she wants, she goes gets it herself, where twin B her body doesn't tell her where to go and what to get what she needs, you know, like if she needs to touch sand or whatever. So they're very different that way. So, you know, for her, you'll have to give her direct, you know, hugs and deep pressure massage and take her for a spin or a run or whatever. She won't do those things on her own.
Okay, so explain to us how your OT taught you about direct and indirect, because that's something that that's a terminology that maybe even some speech pathologists aren't familiar with. So talk with us about how your OT explained that to you.
Okay. So twin A, so she's very independent. She's nonverbal. But for some reason, she knows what her needs are, sensory needs, and she goes gets it herself because I'll find her in the, you know, sandbox, like playing and touching it and grabbing it and sometimes putting it in her mouth, which is not great, but I don't know if that's part of the sensory or her exploration.
Part of the sensory.
Or she'll go jump on her trampoline, or, you know, when she sleeps, she'll push herself against the wall to get deep pressure. So that's indirect, and apparently when she doesn't know a person, she won't come to request what she needs from that person. So that's where the indirect part comes in. It takes her a while for her to trust you to do that. That's why she only comes to me if she needs like a deep pressure hug or people she knows, not just me, but I should say my husband, my mother. But you know, at school, maybe she'll go to a teacher that she really, really likes, but that's about it. So the OT explained that her system is basically telling her where to go to get what she needs sensory-wise.
Uh-huh.
I know she'll go to the trampoline to jump by herself, whereas twin B, it's you need to provide direct sensory input to her because she won't know where to go get it. So you sort of have to guide her based on, you know, you observe her body language and she's very, her most of the sensory issues are oral based. She said that oral motor skills for her are at the level of a 13 to 15 month old where she mouths everything. That's how she explores stuff. So that's what she meant by direct and indirect. I hope I made it clear, but that's what I understood from what she was saying.
I just wanted to hear how your OT explained that to you. And I always love to hear how moms hear
understand
things that therapists say. Yeah, because it gives, as a therapist, it just always provides so much insight with, oh, I could explain it that way, or that's how mom interpreted that. And I always think it's so helpful to clarify with a mom, you know, how did she explain that to you, and what does that mean to you, and how does that make sense to you? So yeah, thank you for explaining that in that way. That was great.
No, that's good. Yeah, I didn't even think of that because you understand and you're like, oh yeah, maybe I should explain. Yeah.
Well, and here's the thing: we have listeners from all over the world, and listeners of, you know, some are moms, some are therapists, some have children that this show will be really, really applicable to. Some moms are just listening because they've kind of gotten in a habit of listening to every show, and this is just kind of what they do, and they feel like they can kind of get little nuggets here and there, even if it's not directly related to their own child. And then as a therapist, I think therapists, again, because of the diversity of our caseloads, even if you think, oh, this show may not be relative to anyone that I'm seeing right now, you never know when 2 or 3 weeks from now or 2 or 3 months from now you're going to get a new child and a new family that this information could be so helpful for you for. So, again, I think we have to kind of keep that in mind. And that's my job as the host of the show to make sure that we're providing that background information and so that everybody feels like, gosh, I'm getting something that's useful to me, if not even right here immediately today, it will be in the future.
I do the same. I listened actually to a few shows of yours last night and I got little nuggets from them. I'm like, oh, yeah, they do that. And you forget about it because there's so much going on.
Exactly.
And you're like, oh, maybe I should bring that up because that's important that I never thought of it. And they're so different. Every child is so different. And, you know, you get people, they're twins. I'm like, no, they're so different in their needs and their, you know, personalities. It's just funny. But it's just, they're yet they have the same issues, but they're so different on how, you know, they need stuff or, you know, their sensory needs have to be met and their speech. It's just, blows my mind.
And I think it's interesting, like you talked about last time, they do both have the same diagnosis, but they're, you know, autism is a spectrum disorder and so is apraxia, meaning that there are varying degrees. And even, you know, if you line up 10 kids with autism, you're going to have 10 different presentations of that. Not every kid is going
to
be exactly. And that's why these cookie cutter approaches don't work, which is what makes my job so interesting, because I'm always, you know, you have to really learn how to work with children and families individually, you know, regardless of what the diagnosis is, because not everything is going to work for every single kid. And again, that's the really cool part to me, because I like digging in and figuring out what's going to work. But a lot of times parents don't understand that, because they think, well, this is my child's diagnosis and the therapist should know this is how you treat it, you know, the 10 steps, but it doesn't work that way. Because like you said, every child is very individualistic. So, okay.
So now that you mentioned apraxia, so when we last spoke, the OT had an inkling that, you know, due to her, the nonverbal one where she doesn't dissociate her mouth from her jaw and the tongue, she suspected a form of apraxia, and she suspected a form of apraxia for Twin B, who has words but only says certain vowels and syllables and stuff like that. She doesn't fully say the word. The only concrete word she'll say is cookie. But the rest of the word, I'll label stuff, but she'll be, if I say baby, she'll say bay. And then it takes her a while to say bee. But it's
to get
just stuff like that, she thought, it's like a milder form, but not like the nonverbal one, who's obviously more severe, I would say. I don't like using that word, but...
say significant.
I know, as a parent, it's like...
I think significant still gives
significant,
it...
Significant,
well,
very good.
Yeah, for me, it still gives it the order of importance, but it doesn't sound doomsday. And you don't ever want to feel that way, about your own child. Or I don't like feeling that way about kids on my caseload either, because I feel like every kid's going to get better no matter where we start. So,
So I wanted to touch a little bit of base on what because we found a new SLP. Somebody referred it to us, and the OT actually referred it to us, and apparently she's 20 years of experience working with kids with autism and apraxia. And so we brought her in for an assessment. She was only able to see Twin A, the nonverbal. So she's coming back to see Twin B. So I mentioned what the OT said, and basically she said apraxia is very hard to diagnose in one session. So I just wanted to run that by you. Is that something that it takes you a while to observe a child to do that? There's not a specific you would do? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And here's the deal. Really, we should wait and see. Well, let me just say this. Most of the time, even when we suspect apraxia with a child, we still want them to be talking well enough so that we have determined what their errors are. Because if a kid isn't talking, it really, you know, well, we suspect it's apraxia or whatever, but really until we hear them and hear and analyze their patterns, we're not able to make that definitive diagnosis. And I totally agree with reserving some judgment and doing that over several sessions or weeks, months. That's really, really common. Now, your girls are turning 4, right, Laura?
Yeah, this Saturday,
Oh, happy birthday, girl.
Yeah.
And let me just say, when children are under 3, and I know you guys are in Canada, but I'm sure it's pretty similar, our National Association, ASHA, the American Speech and Hearing Association, really discourages officially diagnosing children under 3 with apraxia, because so many times, so many different diagnoses look the same. And so you don't want misdiagnosed or give a diagnosis that if you had waited to kind of get some words going and really, again, have some time to analyze those patterns, you're going to just make a more solid diagnosis. So that's why that caution is there. And so I love that you said that she said that, because that tells me she's really smart and knows what she's doing.
Yeah.
You're good information. Yeah.
Yeah, and I was kind of expecting, because I heard so many good things about her, I was kind of expecting her to come in and be like, okay, so let's do this, let's do that. Yes, I can see it. But then she's like, no, and she mentioned the word severe, and she actually told me that it's hard to fix because her case is severe. So I was just like, again, floored. I'm like, no, don't say that. So
but
that kind of discouraged me.
She's saying that because she's almost four and not talking. So no matter mm-hmm. what diagnosis, any professional would feel like the ethical thing to do for you would be to use that more solid terminology just so you get an idea of the enormity of what's going on.
Yeah.
And again, I don't think she means it to, of course, I don't know her. I don't really know you either, you know, beyond these couple of phone calls and all these emails that we've had. But my guess would be she's just saying that because she's turning four and isn't verbally communicating. So that's where the severe comes from. And that is really hard to hear as a mom.
Yeah.
I know that
yeah.
breaks your heart that. But
yeah.
I don't think she's saying that there's no hope. She's just,
right.
I think she's probably saying, hey, this is a pretty big deal.
Yeah, yeah. So
yeah.
It's funny because I get discouraged easily and I just get, you know, from everything we've been through with the other one, it's just, my husband was so great. I told him and he goes, but she didn't say it's impossible, did she? I'm like, no, she didn't. So he's like, see?
That's right.
But he's just,
yeah.
you know, it's great to have that person to sort of give you hope and sort of look the
yeah.
other side. But it's just, you know, when you as a mom, I think that you tend to just like, oh, no, what now? You know? But
yeah, I know.
Anyway.
I know. And it is really hard to lose hope. But let me just tell you, if there, the whole profession of speech pathology and every field of therapy is based on there's hope. There's things
yeah.
you can do. Otherwise, why would we even do all this? Why would this be our
I
job?
Know.
Why would, you know, so there's always, always hope, even if you're starting from that kind of severe place or significant place, whatever you want to
mm-hmm.
call that. So I'm glad you shared that with us because that's a lot of times as therapists, we don't always think about that, how hard it is to hear. And sometimes, you know, a therapist might think, well, she knows that it's severe because her child is four and not really talking yet. But again, as a mom,
oh, yeah.
you know that with your head, but when you start thinking about it
mm-hmm.
from an emotional perspective, it breaks your heart. So
mm-hmm.
Thank you for being
yeah.
so honest and open. You're just like the
yeah,
best mom. Cheryl.
If it helps anybody else, oh, God, I'd be so happy because I go through stuff and I'm like, oh, no, is this how I feel? Is this how everybody feels or is it just me? But I wanted to ask. So you've worked with kids in the past where you took them from like, you know, when they had severe apraxia or nonverbal till they were, I guess you don't do kids over three, but where you got them talking. So there, I know there is hope. It's just, I'm trying to see if, you know, what the statistics are, I guess.
Yeah, and let me just say, because it's, well, first of all, let me just say, I haven't met your little girl, so it's so hard to
yeah.
even take global statistics and apply them to your child, because we all know that one child can totally blow statistics out of the water. But let me just
mm-hmm.
kind of talk about this in general. We know that about a third to about a half, or about half of all children with autism never become functional communicators. So that's just the autism
mm-hmm.
part. And sometimes the
yeah.
parent will hear that and say, gosh, one third to a half, oh my gosh, Laura. And I say, let's just turn it around. That means two thirds of kids with autism to about half, depending on what study you look at, do become functional communicators. And by functional communicators, we mean that they are able to express their wants and needs. They're able to participate in conversation with you. You're able to have that kind of back and forth talking that we all want
mm-hmm.
for our kids. That doesn't mean that they, you know, completely conquer all of their communication challenges, whatever. It just means they're functional, meaning they can tell you what they want, tell you what they need. They talk to express themselves. So that means about a third of kids with autism don't get to that point, meaning that they have struggle. They may mm-hmm. be nonverbal for a long time, possibly forever. And so that's why we have augmentative alternative communication systems. And that's another thing that speech pathologists should be exploring with any child who is frustrated or who has the ability to be able to want to communicate. And if talking is not going to be a short-term fix or a short-term possibility, that's when we really know that we do need to explore systems beyond talking to help them communicate. Again,
yes.
just to alleviate a lot of that frustration and a lot of that pressure. And I really have seen kids who get a device at 2 or 3 or 4, and it takes so much of the pressure off that they do make some progress with talking when we hoped before that they would, but we didn't know that that would happen. So in a lot of cases, getting that alternative system going is again, kind of what helps talking move on.
Yes.
And I do think it's in a large part because that immediate pressure is off.
Yeah. Well, that's what I wanted to touch with, talk to you about this before we move on to poor Twin B, who never gets talked about. Basically, she gave me a little hope where she said, I can see signs of things going in the right direction, because Twin A, what she does is you can tell she wants to communicate, and she does truly talk with her eyes, or she'll take you by the hand, or she takes you whatever, but she will make sounds like she wants to talk. She doesn't know how to form the sounds. So you can
right.
tell she's willing to communicate. So I guess that's a good sign.
Yeah, she's got
Sorry?
Communicative intent. It's called communicative
yes.
intent, meaning that she, you know, you and your therapist pointed this out. She can see that she's trying. She can see that she wants to tell you something, that she
mm-hmm.
Understands that on some, even if she's not understood right now, she understands, even if she can't make herself understood, she knows. I wanted to
yeah,
get
see,
you to
with her, I feel like she understands everything she's told. It's just she can't. Her receptive language, obviously, is like zero. Expressive language. So her receptive
yeah.
language is great because she understands.
Yeah.
So that's why I feel like those are good signs. Do you feel the same way? Like, is there a good sign that you can tell that a kid's moving towards, you know, communicating
yeah.
or becoming verbal or...
Yes, and your therapist will be able to help you walk through that and point out. And again, I think there's so much to be said for children who have some great foundations with receptive language. You would be working a lot harder if she didn't understand what you were saying. And
right.
again, her initiation and her trying, her giving you those
mm-hmm.
signals, if you can't talk, letting you know. I mean, that's communicative, and that's what we always want to see. If she didn't
yeah.
have any of that, that's what she would be working on, and that would be a much less positive predictor if she didn't have that either.
Yes.
So I do think there's some hope there, and just I'm so glad that you have someone who specializes in treating kids
yes.
with autism and dyspraxia. And so it sounds like you've got a really, really good fit. And that she...
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Yeah. I think
and
that's
she
good.
Actually suggested, because I said, this kid needs something to communicate. The last SLP tried you teaching her PECs. But this is the kid who, you know, always never sits down, moves around. Like, she won't attend to an activity for more than a minute. So how do you
yeah.
make her sit down and teach pet? You can't. So it's got to be incorporated in play or, you know, stuff like that. So she suggested using an actual picture of, let's just say, a packet of chips that she likes and placing it on the wall. As soon as she touches that, give her the chips, you know, just so she catches on, oh, if I touch this, I get what I want. Because she basically said, we don't let her request. She just basically goes and gets it herself. Or if she
yeah.
can't reach you, she comes, gets me. So there's no opportunity for her to communicate what she wants, because we're always like, oh, you want this? Okay, here it is. So you don't realize that as a mom till somebody points it out.
Right.
It's like, okay, then. But this is the kid who doesn't get what she wants. You get the tantrums. So again,
yeah.
It's, oh geez,
it's
yeah.
a fine line. Because you don't want to see, some therapists may say to you, okay, well then put everything up that she wants and she's just going to have to learn. Don't do that because that is going to make most of your life living hell. And I've heard that recommended before and I kind of cringe when that happens. To me, that's like throwing a kid, you know, in the deep end of the pool and say, who can't swim, and saying, good luck, you're going to have to learn. It's me. It's mean.
And you put them in a dangerous situation where, you know, right now she figured it out. Oh, it's at the top shelf. Let me get the dining room table chair pushed to the wall, climb on it, and climb on the shelf. Many times I find her on top of my kitchen counters. I'm like, oh, my God, what are you doing?
You can work on those things where, and again, you might always want to use it from a motivating, I know you can do this, let me teach you how perspective, rather than we're going to withhold this from you until you do what we want. Do you see how that's kind of a different perspective? And so I think to you, the only thing that makes PECs work for kids is that we pick the right motivators. The only thing that makes PECs work for kids. And so I think her suggestion with let's use a real life picture, not a black and white or whatever you were using before. Take
those
a picture
stick figures, they do not get, they don't get those. You know, the little standard. They use them everywhere, at daycare, at school. I'm like, you don't get it. I mean, at least I know my kids don't, because they look at it and they're like, okay, I don't know what that is.
Yeah, and I always start with real pictures of real things from their environment, or I have pictures of my toys that if we're going to play with my toys, I have those pictures kind of standard. But any kind of snack or anything that she wants with any regularity, that's what you should be taking your picture from. And just, it's so easy now because, you know, we have almost everybody has a fancy phone.
Oh, yeah.
Where you can take a picture and then go, you know, print it at Walgreens, or I don't know if you have that in Canada, but
Walmart.
Wherever.
No, we don't. We have Walmart. Yeah.
But you can go print it at Walmart and it's cheap and it's easy. I mean, other than getting your phone, getting it plugged in and stuff. But I would really use real pictures with that. Now, I'm not big on putting them on the wall or whatever, but just let your therapist help you work through that. I like it where, with Picture Exchange Communication System, I love how that whole program is set up, because it really is set up with two adults, one child, and I usually let the mom be the person who's giving the child what they want. So you would hold the chips, right? And have the help her, I think we're still talking about twin A here, help her pick up a picture and physically put it in your hand. Now, for whatever reason, your therapist may think that that's not going to work as well for her because you've tried that. She may be thinking, let's do something different with more movement involved. But you'll just, like putting it on the wall or whatever, but you're just going to have to work that out with her. But that idea sounds solid as far as you need to use real pictures and stuff that she really, really loves.
Yeah, because she might just pull it off the wall. Because I've done this trip before with Velcro, and she's like, oh, I can take these off and play with them. Like, she had no idea what those were. I'm like, that's not what the purpose of this is. But, hey, you want to play with them? Go ahead.
I don't let kids play with PECs pictures either, because I want them to know that it's something that they use to communicate. And so when I use PECs, I really sit down with, you know, mom has what the kid wants. I'm behind the kid, helping the kid. We have the picture there. Mom holds out her hand. You know, when the kid reaches for the chips, mom holds out her hand. I help the kid put the picture in mom's hand. Then the kid gets the chips. And I like for it to be very structured like that at the beginning. And that's how the research from PECs is set up. And that's how they've determined, through using it lots and lots of years with thousands of kids, that's the best way to teach it. So if you can make it a little more structured in the beginning, I think it goes a long way with
We'll definitely try. It's just the challenge with her is getting her to sit down and do that. because if she doesn't want to do an activity, you're making her do something, or she'll throw a tantrum, she'll walk away, but she'll come back. If it's not me, if it's a therapist, she'll come back, she'll be like, maybe I should try this, I kind of like this toy. But then, you know, she always has to be in control. So that's why I thought incorporating
it
somehow.
And maybe that's what your therapist is thinking. And again, because I haven't met your sweet girls, it's hard for me to be able to say. I'm just kind of telling you what my starting point would be and why. But always go with what modification that therapist is seeing with you in your house. And if it doesn't work, then you know that you need to pull it back and make it a little more structured. And so, you know, please don't feel like everything I'm saying that, you know, you're going to go back to her and say, I think we should do this, blah, blah, don't do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Follow through and see what's going to work for your child. And then you know that if placing the pictures up doesn't seem to work, you could always back it down to where you're in that more structured teaching environment, which is, again, my preference for that.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, and she also suggested like a ring on your belt with pictures so you have them available at all times, but that just means me walking around with a ring full of pictures everywhere.
Listen, if it does become successful with her, I promise you won't mind wearing this.
I have no problem. Yes.
You won't. And I've seen a lot of teachers who end up doing that because it's too hard to try to go find the darn pictures when you need them.
Mm-hmm.
And if you always have them available, it's much more likely that a child will learn to use them then. And if you can incorporate them all day rather than we're just going to sit down and do this for 5 minutes and then it's over, that doesn't ever become a real life functional system. So she sounds like she has good ideas. Those all sound great.
Oh, good.
And I would follow her. I would follow that path see what's going to happen with that.
Yeah, that's good. Okay. Okay, so I guess we could talk about Twin B now. I don't know how much time we have left, but we would get caught up because there's so much going on. You always want to just keep going. What should I talk about with Twin B? I guess I mentioned that she has a few words, and I started her talking using your, you know, singy song technique, and that worked. They're both very visual, so I guess if I show her something, I have to show her something. I guess many kids do that. You can just say, "Where's the dog?" or say "dog." You can't do that because they don't know. So, you know, either flashcards. Either flashcards. I found Baby Einstein video to be helpful. What else did I try with her? Flashcards, pictures. She loves books with animals, and you point at the animals. So I label everything. So she repeats it, but sometimes she doesn't get, like, it doesn't even sound close to what it is. Or she'll say the first syllable only. So I don't know if that's a sign of some kind of apraxia or it's just her trying to say it, but she doesn't fully get it.
Well, let me just say, kids with apraxia have difficulty sequencing sounds. So that's something that we see frequently in kids with apraxia is that they omit or drop or delete, leave off, whatever you want to call it. They can't do the whole word. They simplify the word because they just get all the sounds in the right places. But let me just say, kids with phonological disorders do that too. And even to some degree, it's typical for younger babies to do that as well.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a natural part of speech language development. But you want to really, and I'm just saying that not necessarily for you because your girls are turning 4, but at the same time, we don't need to make, I just want to kind of throw it out there. It could be, I haven't seen your little girl, so it could be that it's apraxia, but it could be it's just kind of a phonological progression that she's just not caught up to because developmentally she's, you know, her developmental age is different than her chronological age. You know, how many words does she have, Laura?
She has over 20, I would say. I mean, it's not a lot, but I mean, she will, like, everything I say, she'll, like, if I label something, she'll say it in her own way, but.
Good. But, and she's trying to talk. and she's a good.
Oh yeah.
And she's again a pretty good imitator. She understands. Mommy says it, I say it. Mommy says it, I say it. That's a big.
But she won't imitate actions. So that's the thing. Like I can't say go clap, but then I was told that's because she has low muscle tone, so clapping may be hard for her to do. So words, no problem. See, they're the opposite, where twin A will imitate some actions when this one, and won't say words. This one will imitate words, but no action. So, but it takes her a while to say, like, yeah, isn't that weird? It's just funny.
Let me tell you, I have another mom who's from, I'm not going to say what country she's from, but she's not from the U.S. or Canada. I'm Skyping with her, consulting with her. And she has a set of twins. And one has excellent motor skills but really struggling with communication. And then the other one is opposite. The little girl who's talking a lot really struggles with her motor skills. And so, you know, again, you don't think about that with twins, but it happens. You know, it does happen. So completely opposite kinds of issues, And it does make it hard for you to determine what strategy is going to work for what girl.
Yeah. I mean, for communication, I use the same strategies. They both like the singy song voice, you know, the high energy, not, you know, stuff like that. So that works with both. But, so she'll say, like, for example, she started saying, she makes a lot of k sounds. The B sound, and it's funny, the sh sound, which I guess it's a more advanced sound, but she
it
can
is,
say that perfectly. But for when we taught her to say cookie, most of the time she'll say cool and then wait for a while and she'll say key. But it took her a while to say the last syllable. Now she says cookie, but everything's
really
the first syllable.
And that really could be apraxia, but it sounds like your new speech pathologist will be able to tease that out as well. And she hasn't gotten to see her yet. She just saw
not
A,
yet,
right?
No. Yeah, I just don't know how to take her from just saying, you know, those first two syllables to full words and perhaps maybe a sentence, because she understands when we're in the car, she'll say, go, like she wants the car to go and we're stopped. So she knows what means go, like. You know, the purpose of the word, she doesn't just imitate what I say. She knows what it means. I don't know how to get her to move from.
She's going to need more words, Laura, because kids usually, no matter what's going on with them, no matter what the diagnosis is, they really do need a big enough vocabulary before they start to combine words into phrases. Now, some therapists, especially if there's just an apraxia, like no autism, just apraxia, sometimes therapists will work on getting a core set of phrases. But when you have anything else going on beyond apraxia, you really need to work on just building that single word vocabulary first so that that becomes really meaningful, and so that she has, again, a big enough base, a big enough kind of word bank to be able to pull from before she combines words into phrases. So, and usually that's at about 50. Usually kids need about 50 words before they start phrases. Now, some sources will say, you know, 35 to 50, but my experience, especially with kids on the spectrum, has been that they need a pretty big vocabulary of single words that they use all the time before phrases become realistic. So just building that single word vocabulary. And she also needs to have a variety of words. So like in her 20 words right now, are most of those names for things or nouns?
Yes. Well, she'll say go, or that was the only verb really, but most of them are, whatever I labeled, they're nouns,
Yeah, so see, I think what you would spend your time doing instead of working a lot on phrases yet, which may not be realistic, just keep teaching her single words so that you can think about your job is, I'm just going to build her vocabulary up enough so that when she gets enough words and enough variety of words, then it'll kind of kick in and she'll start to combine a lot of those. Your own. Now that's the theory. But here's what else might be going on. If she does have apraxia, you know, she already has difficulty getting that second syllable in a word. It took her a long time, he said, to learn how to do cookie rather than just cook. So she's going to have a hard time sequencing words to make phrases and sentences. You know, so she's got kind of another little issue on top of that.
Yeah. We weren't sure if it's her motor skills because she's at that, you know, like 13 to 15 month old level where, you know, she mouths everything. So we're thinking maybe that's why she's not saying the second syllable. We don't know, like you said, till, you know, she gets assessed or,
yeah.
Okay.
And let me just say, let's back up and talk about this for a second now. You mentioned low muscle tone. If she has a lot of muscle tone, apraxia is not probably going to be the best diagnosis for her. That then, the speech diagnosis for kids with significant muscle tone issues is really dysarthria. And that means there's the muscle component involved, meaning that I know that whole word, I just can't get my muscles to fire fast enough to get those, get all of those sound sequenced. So hers
and what is that called, you said?
Dysarthria. It's spelled D-Y-S.
Dysarthria, okay.
Yeah.
Is that what's common with, is that a disorder that's common with, like, Down syndrome?
Yes.
Dysarthria, okay. Yeah, because it's funny, I just read the article last night on your website that you think you wrote with speech disorders. Okay.
But it just means that the muscle tone issues are the real reason that a child isn't able to. And let me just say this. And again, I haven't seen your girl, so it's hard for me to know. It's impossible. We're just kind of talking about this, and then you're going to be able to decide what fits and what doesn't. But kids with dysarthria, again, have real difficulty okay, let me back up for a second. Kids like with Down syndrome have muscle tone issues throughout their body. They have low muscle tone all over, okay?
Yeah,
now,
that's
certainly,
her.
Okay. So, see, dysarthria is probably a better diagnosis or a better label, terminology, whatever word you pick that fits for you. That's probably, if a kid has all-over muscle tone issues, that would be that diagnosis would fit better than apraxia would. Because apraxia is supposed to really be reserved for kids who don't have neuromuscular involvement, meaning their muscle tone is fine. It's just that they can't program or plan to talk from their little brains. It's like we talked about last time, that little short circuit. But kids with observable muscle tone issues, apraxia usually isn't the best way to explain their speech delay or speech disorder. Does that make sense to you?
That makes complete sense, because this is just for any moms out there, because somebody mentioned low muscle tone to me and I was like, what is that? And when the doctor gave us the diagnosis, when they examined her, these are the kids that are sort of like limp. Like she'll come and give me a hug and she'll just drape over me and just like, bleh. But I mean, it doesn't mean that they can't run or jump or anything. They're just,
And
that's her.
Well, there's a big continuum of muscle tone too. I mean, if we think about even, you know, all of us, even adults, like, Olympic athletes and professional athletes usually have higher muscle tone than me, dumping 49-year-old. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, all of us have kind of a range of muscle tone, and I would be on the lower end of that. You know, I slump when I sit on the floor, and, you know, I'm not running marathons, and, you know, my muscle definition isn't like what those women's soccer players right now playing in the World Cup, totally not like that.
Right.
So muscle tone is a term that's applicable to everybody, not just a kid.
And this is also the kid who sits in the W position. That's a trait of low muscle tone too. So,
exactly.
Okay, well, that's good to know, because the OT said that she doesn't really think it's apraxia. It could be a mild form, but because she's saying stuff, it doesn't, Okay, I'll look into that. But that's awesome that you told me that. Thank you.
Well, and let me just kind of clarify. You can have apraxia and talk. I mean, there are adults with apraxia who talk. So the whole she's talking, she's not talking, that's a factor for apraxia, but not really. Just so you understand that difference. I mean, you can, there are adult speakers who have jobs and who, you know, are completely functional communicators who may be apraxic. So please don't think that, oh, she doesn't have apraxia because she's talking a little bit. That's not really probably, that's probably not true. So, from a diagnostic perspective. Because you can have kids who are real verbal who have apraxia, but then when we analyze their speech patterns, they make vowel errors. They have difficulty combining sounds, you know, and again, they're talking, but because of the types of errors that they make, that's how we know that apraxia is the correct diagnosis. But just sort this out with your speech pathologist and say, hey, what do you think her best diagnosis would be? Is this is she not talking because of the autism? Is she not talking because of the speech component? You know, could it be dysarthria? And she'll be able to kind of tell you that and walk you through all of that based on what she sees in your little girl. And then how she's able to kind of look. And that'll make more sense.
Okay. Yeah, I will do that with her. And the manual that I got that you sent me, the building imitation, a verbal imitation in toddlers is great. So I started working with the nonverbal one, but slowly. I can still use that for the other twin who has words, right?
Yes. Absolutely, because you're going to be working with her at the single word level, so you're going to flip the back of the book. Way up at that level 7, where she is doing single words. The thing with her that I would work on, Laura, if I were you and if I were her therapist, based on what you're telling me now, you know, and again, without her, I would just work a lot on new vocabulary and on adding new words. And you said she has about 20 words. I would want her to have about 50 words, you know, so we would just work on adding words. That would be my biggest goal for her.
Yeah. I mean, she'll come and request stuff from you. She'll tell you the word, but we say she speaks like this totally different language sometimes because it's like, what is that? I know what it means, but I mean, a person hearing it, like for juice, she'll say, phew. I'm like, how do you get that from juice? Like, it's just odd. Like, instead of phone, she'll say phone with a P. It's like, I know what it means, but it's just funny. But it's entertaining because I never got to go through that baby stage where she would say words in a funny way. So now she says it, so it's kind of cute. But you just have to know what she means.
Does she say the same? Does she say the same thing for the same word all the time? I mean, is it pretty consistent? Is phone always phone?
Yes.
Is juice always? Yeah. And see, that's probably more characteristic of dysarthria than apraxia. Because kids with apraxia.
Yeah, she'll say the same thing,
Yeah, kids with apraxia are inconsistent unless it's a really kind of over-rehearsed, meaning a word they say all the time. But kids with dysarthria tend to have the same issues or the same errors in their words, meaning they say it the same way every time. It's wrong every time, but they say it the same way so that you know what they mean over time. And a lot of times kids with apraxia might take a word like phone, and sometimes they say pone, sometimes they say phone, sometimes they say phone. They would, you know, whatever, they may mix up all kinds of sounds, but kids with dysarthria are more consistent. But again, dysarthria is so bit on muscle tone. The biggest factor for kids to get a dysarthria diagnosis is there are muscle tone issues, and that's why their speech isn't understood. And so you'll just have to talk. And then, see, and again, because your girls have autism, that's another factor.
Issue on top of,
Right. So you'll just have to really sort it out. But I'm so glad that you found someone who your OT likes and has a good reputation, and your initial meeting with her went well.
Mm-hmm.
So that sounds good to me.
Yeah, that's really good. I'm happy because, I mean, she was very honest, and, you know, the other SLP we worked with before, you know, she's sort of, not false hope, but she's never really diagnosed anything. She's never looked for things. So mainly like, oh, don't worry, she'll talk. I'm like, okay, when, how? You're not telling me.
Yeah.
So because I got burned to that one, I was so, like, picky with this one. I asked her 20,000 questions, which you should rightfully do so, but I'm glad that she, you know, was truthful
yeah.
and, you know, brutally honest
well,
kind of thing.
Yeah. And here's the thing, too. And I know this is probably going to be harder for some moms to think about and hear, but it's a lot earlier in the process. Lots of times, therapists, especially therapists who specialize in birth to three, again, we are keeping that glass half full, being super positive, trying to take that worry away a little bit. So that it
mm-hmm.
doesn't become, well, mom doesn't feel like this is insurmountable, this will never happen, I don't have any hope, like you were talking about earlier. But then as children get a little bit older,
mm-hmm.
we have a better idea of how things might unfold with how much progress
yeah.
they've made or if progress has been tough. You know, it would be
yeah.
easier for a therapist to feel like she could be a little more, like you said, brutally honest.
Mm-hmm.
Just be the difference in temperament. It could be skill level. It could be that your therapist
yeah.
now is really confident in her abilities and she's just going to tell you what she thinks and she's just going to tell you. And it could be that the other
yeah.
therapist too isn't quite as confident and isn't quite as able to tell you what she really thinks because she's just
yeah.
not yet. So, or it
yeah.
may just not be your personality. She just may be.
She's just like,
sunshine.
Yeah, she doesn't specialize in autism and I don't know. But, yeah, I'm glad. So I'm going to come back and assess Twin B and see how we go from here. But it's just I'm trying to figure out a way to give Twin A an outlet for communicating. So that was my main goal, I guess, main question for
yeah.
today, which you answer. So that's good. And
yeah,
then
and
with Twin B, just expand.
Exactly. And you never want to give up hope for either one of those girls because we all
oh, no.
have heard about kids who are 8 and 10 and 12 who start to talk after
mm-hmm.
all those years. Something
mm-hmm.
clicks. Something happens. Something falls into place. So even though you're working on this other stuff, even though you're doing PECs and whatever else you're working on, nobody would ever say to you, give up on speech. No speech
oh,
at all.
No.
would ever say that. They're just going to want to help
mm-hmm.
you help build some bridges so that you can
yeah.
help her communicate even if her little body isn't ready to talk yet.
Yeah. So, but I don't know if I mentioned this in my last podcast, just on a lighter note. On Mother's Day, she actually put her lips together and she said, mum, 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 over and over again. So it was so I was like, is that the TV? What's happening? Who said that? Is that the dog?
That was a gift.
It's so weird. It was like, I cried. I was like, this is the best
oh.
gift ever. But
oh.
clearly she didn't know what that meant. She was just like, mama, mama, over and over again.
Yeah.
And then she came to give
yeah.
me a hug. And I'm like, what's happening? What just happened now? Can
yeah.
we do this every day? But
yeah. Have you heard it since then? Has she said it since then?
Yeah, she will do it once in a while, but I find that she sort of does it when, I don't know if she wants something, or she'll do like the, like this, like when she's thirsty or something. So at least she's starting to, but I don't know if she associates that with
well, listen, you
requesting.
Have to help her, you have to help her associate that. And sometimes we
yeah.
have to take what she can do and then make it meaningful. So when she's
yes.
doing her, I had a lot of kids do that for
yeah.
when they're hungry. And when you see her doing that, you say, oh, you want something to eat? Let's get a snack. And then, or
right.
you're thirsty, let's get a drink. And so you're really
yeah.
attaching meaning and helping her do that. And so when she says, mama, 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 even if you think that she's
mm-hmm.
not saying it to call you purposefully, teach it that way. Say, yes, mama, I'm here. I'm here. It's mama.
Yeah.
Mama. Yeah, and that,
yeah.
that, you know, sometimes you have to teach it that way. You take what she can do, and you assign the meaning, and then through repetition and time, then she understands. She'll start to understand it.
Yes, that's what I've been doing. But I mean, she doesn't say it a lot, but that's okay. I'll get what she gives me.
Exactly. And see, when she is saying it, Laura, that's your best time to really get it again. So even if you were doing something in the other part of the house and you hear her do that, I tell moms, you drop everything and you get in there and you try to get her to say it 10 times in a row rather than just kind of letting it be a fleeting thing that kind of comes and goes. And so you're going to have to pick those times to really do a lot of purposeful teaching, and by that I mean you're helping her understand that she's saying mama, and that means you.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It's just tough with her with the imitation piece that's sort of missing when you try to repeat it over and over again, and she won't do it again. So you have to build up to that, yeah.
But the best time to get it, if you can, is, when she's when she starts it on her own, when she's initiated.
Oh, yes.
See, that's the kind of best time. Now, listen, with her, are you able to get any kind of, did you say she will do some motor imitation, so some imitation during play or some imitation of some body movements, like clapping, holding her arm?
Clapping, it's funny. She knows how to do because she'll do it when she has a tantrum. So she'll clap, or she doesn't want to do something, she'll clap. I'm like, oh, so you can do it. But when you ask her to imitate, she won't. Jumping, if I take her hands and say, let's jump, she'll jump with me. So that she can do, imitating-wise. But clapping and waving, can't get her to do it. Pointing, she can do. But it's not consistent.
Do you clap when things are, when you've been singing a song, at the end of it, do you clap? Or when, just when something exciting has happened, do you clap? Or, like to congratulate her about something. If she's done something, do you clap and say, yay? That's usually
I do, not as much as I should, but, I try to. But she still won't. Even hand over hand, she'll do it. But then she'll put her hands on my hands to make me clap.
Yeah.
So she doesn't want to do it. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's really common for kids with autism, too.
Yeah.
Kind of respond in that way. But just keep at it. Just keep at that kind of
thing. Oh, yeah.
Will she pat her legs? If you're patting your legs, will she pat her legs?
No.
That's something.
But she'll do it when she's mad. Yeah, no. The only really action, imitation she'll do is the jumping part, or, if we try to dance and we sort of lift our legs up and down, she'll sort of do that, but not really.
Good.
But the jumping is the really only one that she could do. If we do pretend play and, you feed the doll, mommy feed the doll, you feed the doll, she'll do it and then she'll feed me. So pretend play, taking turns, stuff like that, she'll do.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Your girls are really, really interesting, Laura. You've got a really interesting set of twins on your hands with what they'll do.
Oh, I tell you.
I'm so glad
I would just wish it was one set of strategies we can use for both, because it'll make my life easier, but it's not, because they're, one likes music and counting, one like action-based, so,
Well, it never gets dull, and you always have to be on your toes, so look at it that way. Your life will never, ever, ever be boring. And you're going to have lots of opportunities to keep your mind sharp with have to do this for this girl, for that girl, and all of those things. But you have just been such a delight. I'm so happy that I've gotten to meet you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for your time.
You're going to have to keep me updated on what happens. I want you to email me, say, in a couple of months. Let's see, it's the end of June. By the end of the summer, the end of August, I want you to send me an email update and let me know what's happened with your new speech pathologist and see kind of what direction he's got you going in. And then by that time, your OT, you've just kind of started with her, too. So that'll really be up and going. So keep us updated on how those girls are doing.
I will. Thank you so much. And I wanted to ask you quickly, what would be another product to move on from the a manual on your website, like the DVDs, or should we get something else? I know you have something for kids with apraxia and speech disorders. You have a lot of the material, so I don't know what the next best thing would be.
Well, I think just stick with the manual for now. I think the manual is great, but if you want to get one of the DVDs, look at Teach Me to Talk with Apraxia, because that's going to really cover a lot of the basic kind of speech stuff. But listen, Laura, I don't want you to forget about working on their receptive language, because you've got to help them understand and make connections with words. That's huge. But the next one I would probably recommend is that Apraxia DVD and see what you can get going. But listen, your therapist that you're going to work with, who's going to see you and them, I'm sure we'll have lots and lots of great ideas for you, too.
Yeah, perfect. Okay, thank you so much, Laura.
Oh, thank you, and happy birthday to those girls.
Oh, thank you.
Are you having a party?
Laura. We may, yes. Just a small family and friends.
Okay.
Thank you.